Defeat and Victory, an exposition of Psalm 60, verses 1 through 12. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, May the 9th, 2012.
Tonight we're going to be looking at Psalm 60. If you believe what you hear, then if you really trust Jesus, if you really give Him your life, then it really ought to be smooth sailing from here on out. So many teach and act as if trust Jesus and all will be well. That the people of God don't struggle and fight and have difficult days. To experience His grace is to live carefree. Well, try to tell that to David. Try to tell that to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Try to tell that to believers through the ages, Old Testament and New, who were faithful, who were consistent, who loved the Lord, and who suffered greatly in this life. We live in a fallen world. And as long as we live in a fallen world, we're going to have hardship and trouble. In fact, Jesus said, in this world, you will have trouble. So, Peter says, don't act like something strange is going on because you're having difficult days. Understand that's life and the world that you're called to live in. David reigned as king of Israel during a time when he was moving the nation into what became known as the Golden Age. And when you read the account in 2 Samuel, starting in about chapter 5 and the next several chapters, you could get the impression it just got better and better. Because in that section, things were going really, really well. In chapter 5 of 2 Samuel, David becomes king over all of Israel. He finally solidifies the nation, and they're all under him in one kingdom. The next section of chapter 5, he captures Jerusalem and makes it his capital. Following that, David achieves a decisive victory over the Philistines. In chapter 6, he brings the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, and it becomes the place of worship. Chapter 7, Nathan the prophet comes and announces that God is going to establish David's throne forever. So if you stop there and you only read those three chapters, you say, boy, it doesn't get any better than that. Must be a wonderful life to be the Lord's anointed. But the context says otherwise. And the context of Psalm 60 tells us it wasn't all rosy. In fact, Derek Kinder in his commentary in dealing with this psalm says, except for this psalm and its title, we would have no inkling of the resilience of David's hostile neighbors at the peak of his power. In other words, you read some accounts, then you say, boy, he just mowed everybody down. But he's saying if you read the whole account, it becomes clear his neighbors were resilient. And they came again and again and again against him and fought him tooth and nail throughout his reign. Place this psalm in its historical context, and we're reminded that in times of even unprecedented blessing, there are crushing defeats. And that, I think, is what makes it really, really difficult. Because when you're riding high and things are going well, and you think, I finally made it, we're finally going to have some smooth waters, then something happens and just knocks the wind out of your sail. And you go through some hard, crushing, difficult time, and you wonder, what in the world is going on? Why did I have it so good for this period only to be slapped down again? But there's an important life lesson for us. In a fallen world, we're in the process of being made holy. And life is often a picture of contrast. Joy is tempered with sorrow, and victory is often crowned with defeat. That's life in this imperfect world, and that's the context of Psalm 60. The historical setting is 1 Samuel chapter 8, the first 14 verses. The world was upside down. Things were unpredictable. Things were difficult, as David wrote this psalm, and the message that comes through is that peace of mind and heart in our complex, confused world demands a biblical worldview. The only way we can have any peace is to see the world as God sees it. To have the faith to trust Him. Peace isn't going to come because it's a peaceful world. Peace isn't going to come because everything is finally under His control and everything is in its place and everything is clearly marked. Until He comes and establishes His kingdom physically here and the end of this age comes, there's not going to be peace. Peace comes to the heart that is focused on Christ and has a mindset, a worldview that is in keeping with the ways of God. A worldview is simply that, a way of viewing the world. It's the template by which you interpret everything going on around you, the grid by which you interpret life around you. It's the thing that makes sense out of life. And there are three pillars to this biblical worldview that I want to point out as we work our way through this psalm. The first one is in verse 1 down through verse 4. A biblical worldview sees the hand of God in everything. That's the first thing we need to understand. If you have a biblical worldview, if you're going to look at the world through the proper grid so that you can understand and you can interpret it, you're going to need to see the hand of God in everything. David begins, God, You have rejected us. You have broken out against us. You have been angry. Restore us. You have shaken the land and split it open. Healed its fissures for its shudders. You've made Your people suffer hardship. You've given us wine to drink that made us stagger. You've given a signal flag to those who fear You so that they can flee before the archers. Every worldview has its own set of presuppositions. Those things that we accept, those things that we say are true, they are the givens by which we interpret the world around us. All of us have presuppositions, those things that we assume to be true from the outset. Here are the building blocks of this process. The first one is that God is here, that God exists. The second is that God is a person. He's not a power. He's not an influence. He's not a thing. He is a person. That implies the ability to relate, the ability to communicate, the ability to interact. And the third is that He is actively involved in and with His creation. That's our starting point as Christians. This is where we begin. We begin with these assumptions. Have you noticed that the Bible does not begin with giving you evidence that God exists? How does the Scripture begin? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a given that God exists. And that He is personal. And that He is active. That He is involved in the creation. Now, I believe the Scriptures substantiate each of these assumptions. But my point is, this is where we start. This is the base for our understanding of the world and the base from which we begin to interpret what's happening in our lives, in our family, in our culture, in our city, in our world. I'm convinced that God, by His very being, controls everything. Or He's not God. I mean, we live in strange times because we live in a time when people want to confess that God exists. There are even those who want to confess that God is sovereign. He just doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know the future. I mean, there are serious writing theologians who say they believe the Scripture and the basis for what they're teaching is found in the Scripture. They say, yeah, God is there and He's very powerful, but He has no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. He's got an idea. But He really didn't know, because it hadn't happened yet. And God can't possibly know what hasn't happened. Well, I begin with the assumption, if God exists, He's God, And part of being God is that you know all things. And as the creator of everything that exists, you have power over everything. I have no trouble believing in, confirming, confessing the sovereignty of God. And the longer I live and the more I experience, the more convinced I am that God is in control. Even when it appears He isn't. And the basis of my understanding is His Word and what He has declared and what He has decreed concerning Himself. Listen to Colossians 1, 15 through 17. He is talking about Christ. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by Him all things were created in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authority. All things were created through Him and for Him. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. Christ, as God, created everything. And everything still exists because He wills it to exist. And He holds all things together by the power of His might. It coheres, it fits, it makes sense. It's not just that physically it's held together, though that's part of it. But also that it fits and that it makes sense. The only way you're ever going to make sense out of this world is to see it from God's perspective and to understand that He's in control. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. So this is our starting point. Habakkuk 1 and verse 5, among the nations, look among the nations and see, wonder and be astonished, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. You remember the context? The Babylonians are coming. And they know that that means trouble. And they know the difficult, horrible days are ahead for them. And God said, oh, you don't understand the half of it. The Babylonians are coming and they're my instrument. And all that they do to you is because I'm doing it to you through them. That's what He means when He said, you wouldn't believe it if I told you. God is there. He is sovereign over all things. He is actively involved in His creation. This is our starting point. Now, we get a bit weak in the knees when we think about that. We don't like that. We're uncomfortable with that. Why? Why are we uncomfortable with God being sovereign over everything? If you say God is sovereign over everything, and nothing can happen unless God allows it to happen, then won't He get blamed for some things that He ought not to get blamed for? I mean, isn't that how we argue? Isn't that what we're concerned about? We want to say, well, all the good stuff is God's doing, but all the bad stuff, that's all of the devil. What we fail to recognize is what Martin Luther tried to say during the Reformation. Even the devil is God's devil. We do not live in a dualistic world where there are these two powers that are equally strong and they're fighting it out. God is sovereign over all things, including Satan and all evil. God is sovereign. He's over all things. We worry that God's going to get blamed for something. Apparently, David's not concerned about it. Look at how he begins. God, you have rejected us. You have broken out against us. You've become angry. Now, restore us. You have shaken the land and split it open. Healed its fissures where it shudders. You've made your people suffer hardship. You've given us wine to drink that made us stagger. You have rejected us. You have broken down our defenses. You've been angry. He's blaming God for Israel's woes? Well, not exactly. He's not blaming God, but he is acknowledging that God is responsible. And he is. There are times when I'm happy to acknowledge and confess that. Especially when something's happening to my enemy, I'm really happy to say, you know, God's in that. My problem is when it's not going so well for me. But the same thing is true. God is in that. God is doing that. God is bringing that about because it's ultimately serving His purpose. Again, we can't pick and choose when we embrace the sovereignty of God and when we push it away. Either He's in charge or He's not. Either He is Lord over everything or He is not. David uses two powerful images to demonstrate the devastating effect of God's judgment. In verse 2, he refers to it as an earthquake, shaking, splitting the land. It's symbolizing shaking that which they thought secure that could not be shaken. And the second is drunkenness, wine that makes us stagger. They're left reeling from what they have experienced. Internal confusion and shock as they suffer. And they have to recognize that God is in all of this. A biblical worldview sees the hand of God in everything. That doesn't mean I understand everything. It doesn't mean that everything always fits in a nice package. And it doesn't mean that I like it. But I accept that there will always be mystery, that I will never have complete understanding. But there is always an awareness that God is in charge. And where did we get the idea that God owes us an explanation? It's pretty clear to me throughout the Scriptures that He doesn't. Sometimes He gives us an explanation. Sometimes He lets us know. Other times He doesn't. I mean, read the story of Job. Job is described as the greatest man in the East. In fact, when Satan came to appear before God, God brought Job into it, not the devil. God brought him into it. God said to him, "You know, have you considered my boy Job? He's the finest example of anybody down there." Really? Well, he's only like that because you got a hedge of protection about him. Withdraw that, and I'll guarantee you he'll curse you. And God said, "Go right ahead." And all that destruction came. Read the entire book of Job, and here's something you need to note. Nowhere is Job ever given an explanation for why any of it happened. In fact, when he gets to the point that he starts demanding an explanation, God firmly put him in his place. Do you remember how He did it? "Job, were you there when I created everything? Because I don't remember your being there. Did you advise me? Were you my consultant on this job?" "No, then maybe you need to be quiet." That was the response. Job finally came to learn we don't have to know why, we just need to know who. Why is not as important as who. In the midst of your trial, in the midst of your struggle, when all hell is breaking loose in your world, and you're upset, and you're mad, and you're confused, and you're hurt, and I understand all of that, and our Father understands all of that, you're going to be miserable if you demand an answer because you may never get it. What you need to cling to is who? To trust the One who is sovereign over all things. And to yield to Him and say, "Father, I don't understand it." And it's even all right to say, "Father, I don't like it. But You're God and I'm not. Grant me courage, grant me faith, grant me the ability to believe and to trust." That's what's happening in this section. Understanding there will always be mystery. There will be things I don't understand. I never will. And you know, sometimes we think, "I know I don't understand it now, but I'll understand all things when I get there." No, you won't. Because you'll never be God. And only God understands all things. Truth is, when you get there, it won't matter anymore when you're in His presence. And you're transformed into His likeness. A biblical world a biblical worldview sees the hand of God in everything. Beginning in verse 5 and down through verse 8, we discover that a biblical worldview sees God as sovereign over all things. Save with your right hand and answer me, so that those who love you may be rescued. God has spoken in His sanctuary. I will triumph. I will divide up Shechem. I will apportion the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is my helmet. Judah is my scepter. Moab is my wash basin. I throw my sandal on Edom. I shout in triumph over Philistia. Verse 5 expresses hope. Save with your right hand. Answer so those who you love may be rescued. It is a prayer of faith based on the truth expressed in verses 6 through 8. David is praying for God's deliverance, and the basis of his prayer is not that they deserve to be delivered or that God owes it to them. The basis is the character of God as expressed in verses 6 through 8. God has spoken in His sanctuary, and He said, I will triumph. I will divide. He speaks of the assurance and deliverance of God. David is absolutely confident that God will deliver. Verses 6 through 8 are dominated by God's presence. It's not a picture of petty rivals struggling for supremacy, but a statement of God's sovereign control over all peoples. Verses 6 and 7, David gives a poetic summary of Israel's early history. Shechem and Succoth are on either side of the Jordan River, where the first parts of the promised land that were occupied by Jacob. Gilead was the Israelite territory east of the Jordan. Manasseh straddled the river, and Ephraim and Judah were principal tribes to the west. The use of mine and my throughout is emphasizing God is in control and He is sovereign over all of these. He's sovereign over all of Israel and its history. The same is even said of His enemies in verse 8. These proud, arrogant lands, and they're described in very degrading terms. Moab is my wash basin. A fitting word for a proud and arrogant people. I throw my sandal. That's a form of derision. I shout in triumph over Philistia. God is sovereign over those who acknowledge His lordship, and He is sovereign over those who deny His lordship. You ever heard somebody encourage you to make Jesus Lord? You do know you can't do that. All you can do is acknowledge He is Lord. Because He's Lord whether you ever let Him be or not. That's who He is. He's Lord over those who acknowledge Him, and He's Lord over those who refuse to acknowledge Him. And that's the basis of David's confidence in pleading with God to deliver His people. That's why David could say in Psalm 2, the nations plot in vain. The nations do all their planning, the kings of the earth get together, and they devise their plans, and He who sits enthroned in the heavens laughs. He scoffs. He mocks. See, I think that's an important word for us. I think it's a timely word. Because we do need to understand that we have nothing to fear ultimately from those who seek to dominate the world. Please don't misunderstand me. Fearful, awful things may very well happen. But I'm saying ultimately we have nothing to fear as the people of God because we know how it ends. We may go through hell. We may suffer greatly. Our children and grandchildren may suffer greatly. But ultimately, the people of God will triumph. Because God is sovereign over all things. That's the confidence of the people of God. And that's what we must cling to, especially in a world that is going through what our world is going through now. And all the fears and all the worried about who's being elected and what that means and the possible repercussions. I'm saying it's legitimate to be concerned about all of that. But we don't live in absolute paralyzing fear because our God is in control. That's a biblical worldview. I had to go out on a call yesterday evening, and while we were waiting for the word back from the family about releasing some of the property of the deceased, I was visiting with a police officer, and he said, "So what do you think about all this stuff going on?" Well, first, I didn't know what he was even talking about. I didn't know if he's talking about stuff going on within the department, whether he's talking about stuff in the city or whatever. So I said, "I don't know. I guess I don't know enough about what's going on." Figuring then he's going to tell me what he means by it. And he says, "Well, I just figured with you being a chaplain, you would have some opinion." I said, "Opinion about what?" "Well, the world and all this going on." "I'm not worried about it." And he couldn't believe it. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You know, I told people and they thought I was a fool a long time ago about you should buy gold and you need to do this." And I said, "You know, that's not going to matter ultimately. I'm not worried ultimately because I know who wins. Yeah, I'm worried about what could happen. I'm worried about what I might go through. I worry more about what my children and grandchildren are going to go through. But ultimately, I'm not worried about it. Because petty dictators have come and gone for the whole history of the world. But there is one who triumphs over all. And as the people of God, there is our hope. Therein is our confidence. The point of all of it is God is sovereign, and we must learn to trust Him. Third, verse 9, down through the end of the psalm, verse 12. A biblical worldview graciously submits to God's will in everything. Who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? God, haven't you rejected us? God, you do not march out with our armies. Give us aid against our foe. For human help is worthless. With God, we will perform valiantly. He will trample our foes. He's come full circle. What began as an urgent plea for God to do something, a God to bring an end, to bring peace, to bring quiet, now he rests in the assurance that God is in control. The enemy that once invaded has become the one invaded. What was once a lonely venture has become a partnership. Lord, go with us. Human help is worthless. I don't think either political party is going to use that as their slogan moving into their conventions. But it might be refreshing. It might be refreshing to hear a politician stand up and say, human help is worthless. But our God will march in triumph. That's our perspective. That's what it means to have a biblical worldview. It's not arrogant. It's not proud. It's just understanding that God is real, that He is a person, that He's active and involved in His creation, and that He can be trusted. Peace of mind and heart in complex, confused, difficult times demands a biblical worldview. A worldview that sees the hand of God in everything, that sees God as sovereign over all things, and graciously submits to the will of God in everything. that we learn to pray daily, regularly, about all the stuff going on in our lives. Father, not my will, but your will be done. Peace, assurance, is found when we trust in the God who is sovereign over all things. Therein is our hope, and only there.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.